I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about foster care. We're going to discuss what foster care is and the challenges that both children and providers face. We will talk about a system to design to serve the children who most need our support. My guests are Tina Klor of the Children's Bureau, Angela Wolf, foster care specialist with the Indiana Department of Child Services, and Gwen Collell, director of Damar Foster Care Services. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about foster care. If you'd like to be part of this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Tina Klor, who is with the Children's Bureau, Angela Wolf, who's a foster care specialist with the Department of Children's Services, and Gwen Collell, who is director of Damar Foster Care Services. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. So we probably ought to talk. I try not to make assumptions when we do this program that everyone understands what we are talking about. So I'm going to ask first, and I think I'll start with Angela on this one. How foster care works, what it is. Can you give a brief sort of description?
Foster care is trying to provide a safe, stable, nurturing home environment when children cannot be placed with their families. So we're looking for that. Sometimes we look to relatives, but when a relative option is not available, we need to place them in homes.
And how do we find the people who provide those homes? I'll throw that one to Tina.
I think overall DCS does a good amount of advertising. The private sector agencies that also do foster care advertise. I think we found over the years the most effective way of finding foster families is through other foster families. Word of mouth is very effective, and then also through internet marketing and trying to educate folks about the need.
How many people are involved in the foster care system here in the state?
You know, that's a good question. In terms of, you know, number of foster homes, I know every agency may be dependent on how long they've been providing service to families and children, have a different pool of available foster homes. But what I will say is I know every agency is definitely in need of more families to be able to serve the children that are in need.
How many children do we serve through this? Anyone? We're all looking here. Go ahead.
Yeah. It's such a fluid number. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a daily changing number, probably approximately 10,000 children in care in some realm, whether that is an in-home involvement or it is for out-of-home. So in foster care, we have tremendous need. All of our homes are full. We're close to full, and we need good homes.
Okay, so at any given time, it's about 10,000 children, would you say?
I'm kind of throwing that number out there.
Or is there, we track it over the course of a year rather than saying day to day? How many, in the course of a year, how many children are served?
In the last year in Marion County, the number is just under 10,000.
Okay, so and that's just in Marion County.
Yeah, statewide it's about 20,000 right now. Okay. And those numbers are up significantly.
Okay, so the numbers are up significantly since when?
In the past year and a half, we have seen a huge influx in the number of children coming into the system. There are issues going on with parents surrounding often the heroin issues increasing and the use of meth and other substances that are rendering those parents incapable of taking care of their children. So the system across the state has seen significant increase, and it's also a national trend.
So are we on pace with the national trend, or behind it or ahead of it? Do we have those numbers broken down? Tina, you're the one who seems to have those numbers at your disposal, so we'll throw it back.
Indiana's running ahead of much of the rest of the country on the use of heroin and abuse of heroin. So that is driving a lot of the increase that we're seeing in the child welfare numbers here. So I think nationally the numbers are up. I think we're probably up beyond what the national norm is.
Is there, aside from substance abuse, what are the other reasons that children are placed at, you know, removed from presumably their birth or at least their legal home, their presumptive home, and then and placed in foster care?
There's definitely a multitude of reasons. I would say some of the more prevalent ones would be financial hardship, domestic violence, educational neglect, medical needs of children or higher level of needs, and then just maybe unsafe, unstable family environment where the children need to be removed for a short period or longer period of time.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about foster care today on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. You can do what a listener named Kathy has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, my path just crossed with a young woman in Nashville, Indiana, Brown County. It's my understanding from her counselor that she was in the foster system, but it just wasn't working for her, and she is currently living with an administration person in the Brown County High School. My question is, what safety nets are in place? There's a quote-unquote homeless problem for kids in Brown County, and some of these kids have been in the foster system, and it hasn't worked for them, and now they're they're quote-unquote homeless. Some of them are living with some of the high school teachers. I just wonder what safety nets are in place if foster homes, maybe one doesn't work, what the system allows for, so that those kids are not just floating around to teachers' or administrators' homes. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Kathy. Mm-hmm. Who would like to take that one?
I can take it.
Okay.
Typically, if a child has been in a foster home, we don't give up after just one home. We work towards finding a suitable placement for a child. And there's been some form, possibly in this situation or in others, of a reunification plan. So if they're with an administrator and our department was to be involved, we would have safety nets. There would be background checks and different things that would be in place to make sure it is a safe placement.
How is it, you know, when you say that there's a need for foster homes, foster parents, providers, how do you go about attracting these people, getting them involved in the system? And speaking to Kathy's question, what kind of investigation is there to make sure that they are that the situation that they're in is going to be better than the one the kid left?
Well, I think we have two questions there.
Yeah.
I said, as far as we do outreach, we're trying to get out into communities through word of mouth, through churches. I've had a couple of different churches and communities reach out to me and ask me to come and speak and put up a booth in their church. We put up booths at local county fairs, community involvements. Anytime there's a gathering, and if we can make a presence, we try to. But as Tina had said earlier, one of the best ways is word of mouth from other foster parents, people who know them and want to make a difference as well. It's not easy to get the word out. And so I think, and when people do, they're scared. So to hear from someone else who's doing it, who is a foster parent and enjoys it, speaks volumes over just reading a billboard.
What, you know, in terms of attracting them, what, I'm presuming that they are compensated, obviously, at some level for the work that they do.
Yes, we have a reimbursement plan set up to help compensate for the needs of the child. It's based on a plan of what it would cost to help with their food, their clothing, and provide for them.
Okay.
It's not a job.
It's not a profit-making venture or anything like
that.
So you have to do it out of basically out of the goodness of your heart, and you might recoup some of the costs that you incur. I want to get to the second part of that, too. How do we make sure that these are, because my guess is that there are some people who say they want to be foster parents who are doing so without the best of motives. How do you weed those folks out?
I can speak to that a little bit. You know, it's a pretty lengthy process, and an individual or couple going through it really needs to be emotionally invested, have the time to be invested in the process. And on our end as a licensing entity, we are responsible for verifying that, you know, they are safe individuals, you know, have appropriate backgrounds. And we assess for, you know, family stability, and that, you know, adding a new child or a new sibling group to their home will not cause disruption to either their family or the child coming into care. So we make assessments on background checks and stability of the family, and making sure that, you know, there's financial stability as well.
What's the profile of the ideal foster parent or foster family that you look for?
Yeah, we're all laughing.
There isn't one.
Well, what qualities do you start with?
I think we look for families that are pretty mission driven, that are invested in the outcome for youth in our community. Families can be anything from your traditional couple to, you know, a grandma who has an empty nest and wants to take children, to same-sex couples. I mean, we get a little bit of everything, and they all can be excellent foster homes, foster families. We're really looking for people who have the time, energy, resources, and the understanding to care for kids who've had hard lives, you know, because the kids that we bring into the system, you know, often the issue that they were that caused their removal from their home probably wasn't an isolated incident. Mm-hmm. You know, they've probably experienced some...
It's not just one bad day.
Correct. Yeah. So they've experienced neglect and trauma over a course of time in many situations. And so the kids come into the situation not always being the most trusting of adults and, you know, carrying a good amount of hurt around with them.
And, you know, in terms of the purpose, what, you know, when you place a child in a foster home, what is the outcome that you're looking for there? I mean, is it that the foster family will raise this child, or is it attempting to deal with the problems that led to the removal first and then placing the child back in?
But there's different roles here.
Mm-hmm.
The foster parent's role is to be providing that stability, the home environment. The Department of Child Services will be in charge of working with the family, trying to rectify the situation, because our first case plan goal is always reunification. So we will be trying to help get that home environment to be, if possible, the safe, stable environment that the children need to be able to go home. So it's not necessarily gearing up from the get-go that you're going to be raising these children forever. It's trying to help make a difference and help get them in a better place for when and if they do return home.
I would think, Gwen, that that's got to be a difficult thing, though, for a foster family to say, okay, we're going to commit to helping this child, with the idea that ultimately said child may go back to that situation at any time. That
Yeah, we come across that, you know, pretty often, and really working with our families to understand, you know, the temporary nature of foster care and their role for whatever given time that is for that child. So giving all that they have to this child, but we work with them on the emotional components and being able to understand that they've made an impact, they've made a difference, whether it's for 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years. And that child may move on and move, you know, from their care and from their life, but we'll hopefully take with them those experiences that they had in the foster home with that, you know, stability. So we do work with families who, you know, maybe are looking for... definitely to adopt, but that's not always going to be the case. So we want to be able to support the families through that kind of temporary nature of foster care.
How long is the process, you know, once you've identified a family, of sort of vetting the family and deciding, okay, this will work or this won't work? I'll stick with you on that one, Gwen.
I think it can take various amounts of time. I mean, ideally in my world, it's about, you know, 3 to 4 month process. you know, for the vetting and the
to do the background check
and the training.
And the training. And I'll tell you what, I do want to talk about the training that goes into this, because it does sound like it would be a somewhat specialized skill set that we're talking about. But we'll pick that up after the break. We are talking about foster care here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Tina Clore, who is with the Children's Bureau, Angela Wolf, who's foster care specialist with the Department of Child Services, and Gwen Collell, who is director of Daymar's Foster Care Services. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about foster care today on No Limits. My guests are Tina Clore, who's with the Children's Bureau, Angela Wolf, who's foster care specialist with the Department of Child Services, and Gwen Collell, who is director of Daymar Foster Care Services. And I should say, if you want to take a closer look at this subject, you can go to our website, wfyi.org/side effects, where you're going to find some sterling reporting from our partnership with the folks at Side Effects on this issue of foster care. We were talking before the break about sort of the vetting process, and left off just before we got to, you know, what goes into training these folks, because it is a specialized skill set. I will start with Gwen on that, but I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts real quickly. I'll start with...
We take all of our families. We're on a private agency, so we take all of our families through a minimum of 20 hours of pre-service training, and then medical training and certification as well, with a focus on helping them build empathy for the families that do have children removed, understanding some of the challenges and needs that the children coming into care will have based on their trauma and experiences. We discuss the different types of abuse and neglect. What am I missing?
I'll tell you what, Tina, we'll toss it your way. What other sorts of training go into this?
I think there's a good amount of training about some of the legal aspects of being foster parents, what they can do, what they can't do, appropriate discipline for children in foster care. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have the same amount of options that, you know, that other parents might have, because these are the state's children. You know, we work a lot around helping them understand trauma and how trauma impacts children in their behavior, in their emotional stability, how to parent kids who've experienced a lot of trauma appropriately, you know, about what the expectations are, you know, in terms of how they're going to interact or not interact with the biological families, the need for them to... you know, meet the needs of the kids in terms of their medical needs, educational needs, getting them to visits with their parents, just what all those expectations are, so that people come in really understanding what they're signing up for.
Angela, how often do people wash out of this system? Because it sounds like, frankly, it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a significant commitment.
It is. We don't wash out that many, surprisingly.
Okay.
I think these people are absolutely amazing who dedicate their lives to these children,
because
they're truly opening up their home, their lives, and they're really dedicated to helping these kids. But more than anything, I see maybe experienced foster parents who they gave a certain amount of time, and maybe things in their own life have changed, and maybe it's just not a right fit, because it is very much a time commitment. To dedicate to getting the children to their medical appointments, their therapy appointments, or visitation requirements. It's very time-consuming at different times, depending on someone's work schedule. Sometimes different things in their lives change, or divorces it happens to amongst foster parents. And so it's more, I don't have many people who just absolutely turn away and think of it as a horrible experience. Everybody's leaving with a good experience.
We turn over foster parents more often because they've adopted our children. Yes. Mm-hmm. And once they adopt your children, their number of kids that they can have in their home is limited. And so that's the most frequent reason that you lose foster families, at least for us.
Yeah.
We are talking about foster care here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what Catherine has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Yes, I was just wondering if the need is so great. I've been hearing on the radio ever so often since last summer that the need is so great for foster parents. Why the process takes so long. I think that might turn some people away because it's like, well, this is a lot of time, and couldn't the process be shortened in any way, shape, or form? Because it's like I used to think, well, that's the way they weed out all, the maybe not the best suitable parents, but it's like they get through whether the process is long or not. But is there a way to shorten the process?
Angela, I'll throw that one to you. Catherine, thank you very much for the call and the question.
Thank you.
The time value that comes with it is us getting to know the foster family as well as helping to educate the prospective foster families for us to best match children's needs with the appropriate family. Sometimes throughout the process and it taking a little bit of time, sometimes, as we were referring earlier, sometimes we can find problems within prospective foster families that don't make them strong candidates, or we can earmark that maybe a certain behavioral type of a child or an age group is not best fitted for them. So it would be beneficial if it could be quicker because we so need the homes. But by the time we get through the time commitment also for the foster parents to invest in CPR first aid training, that's an all-day course, it can be. And it just takes time to get through all the different classes, the background checks. And then furthermore, for us to get to know the foster parent and their whole family, it takes time to get to know each of the applicants and if they have children, to find again how we can best fit children in their home.
We've also received a Facebook message from a listener who wished to remain anonymous. And I should say, if you wish to reach out to us by Facebook, you can private message us and find us at No Limits WFYI. This listener says, "We have been foster parents for 6 years in Marion County. In the last 2 to 3 years, we have seen a huge change. High turnover, I'm trying to get the computer to cooperate here, with assigned caseworkers and poor communication with caseworkers and their supervisors. I believe foster parents have to be advocates for not only the children but themselves. Our last placement, the team surrounding the child did not feel we should have a voice in the outcome of the child. We were not notified of meetings and usually the last told about changes in the case. She went back to a very unstable home after being pulled 3 times in less than 2 years. We have been big supporters of foster care and have encouraged other people to get involved, to become foster parents. However, with all the changes, we no longer do this." Well, that's got to be disturbing. Tina, I'll throw that one your way.
I think, with the significant increase in the number of children entering the system, that it has caused some issues in terms of capacity and access to resources. I think, Governor Pence has been good about giving DCS the resources that they need to add case managers so that they can get the caseload sizes down so that, they can get responses and all those types of things. The details around how teams are formed, the family's actually in charge of who's on their child and family team. So that's sometimes an interesting dynamic to work your way through. I do think that there are folks who are, I know we have case managers that are in the homes a couple of times a week. We're relaying information all the time. We keep them as informed as we can possibly keep our folks, but it is a process it's right now things are full, mm-hmm. And it's been a struggle.
Is it a funding? I mean, is a large part of this funding? It sounds like I know enough about the way the state budgeting system works that it is not a nimble mechanism. It does not respond quickly, and it sounds like you have seen a very rapid acceleration in the demand for services. Is it simply that there's a lag in getting things together, Angela?
I think it's just it's a time process, and it just to keep staff. You have to remember, this is a very stressful dealing day in and day out. That sometimes even the secondhand trauma on our workers, the high demand, the work level itself, in addition to just dealing with the trauma of the children, it burns out a lot of people, and they try to put supports in for the workers to try to help make a better environment. And they're very supportive and offer counseling if needed. But the secondhand trauma sometimes catches up with people as well.
Got a question that's on point here. An email came from a listener named Heather. And if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Heather says, I was wondering what kind of support groups are available for new foster families. I'll throw that one to Gwen.
Well,
largely because you were sighing as if you were ready to speak.
So I know our agency, when we're working with either new families or families that have been doing it for a while, we hold support groups for our own families. And I believe other agencies and licensing entities do that as well for the families within their own network. I believe, and I don't know any names of them offhand, but there are other support groups within communities, both for foster parents and adoptive families. And I know different counties have some different groups in the areas.
They get a lot of individual support from their workers also. Right. You know, they call, we know our families, we talk to them regularly. They know that they can call the therapist at our office, the supervisor at our office, the case manager at our office, and they're going to get a response. We also use a closed group that you can go to through a it's basically a closed website where our foster families can support each other. So if somebody needs an infant bed or a toddler bed or whatever, that they can share resources and talk about things inside a closed group, but through the use of technology.
Is this a need though, a kind of a gap? Because it does sound like these are rather specialized pressures, and that people who aren't actually serving as foster parents or foster siblings aren't necessarily going to understand it. And sometimes it's not so much that you need help or advice. You just need somebody who understands that you can talk with for a few minutes. Is there that kind of formalized network in place, or is that something that would be helpful?
I know we try to encourage that. Mm-hmm. You know, our case managers and our staff can know all of our families and be there to support them 24/7. But at the same time, you know, we're not the ones doing this work, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and we can't always speak to how a foster parent is exactly feeling in that moment. We can be there to support them and help guide them through, but we're not in it day to day. We don't have a foster child in our home. So I strongly advocate for foster families to network and to get to know one another, because they are their greatest support.
We are talking about foster care here on No Limits. Sasha, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I personally grew up in foster care in the state of Indiana from the age of 13 on up. You know, I graduated high school and was emancipated. So my question is, what programs are we encouraging our youth that are a little bit older to be involved within the foster care system with state legislation, advocacy, policies that directly affect them? Because obviously they know how it feels more than anybody to be a part of that system.
Before I let you go, Sasha, I mean, if you were recommending a change or improvement or a tweak to the system, what would it be since you've been through it?
Well, the biggest thing that I would say is, because I was an advocate for foster youth from the age of 16 to 22 for the state of Indiana, you know, I have done a lot of things to help improve the state dealing with foster care. But the main thing that I would say is letting children have the voice, asking them what they think is the best direction for them to go, asking what policies or what regulations do you personally have as a licensing facility or as a foster home, those types of things, like what means the most to them. You know, there is a group in Indianapolis that's called the Youth Advisory Board. It's a state-funded board, and it is absolutely amazing, but there's not a lot of foster kids that know about it, so they're not able to have their voices heard at a state level.
Thanks very much for the call and for sharing your insights and the question, Sasha. I'll go to Angela first.
They've started some different programs to help our aging out and older youth. Specifically, it's referred to as the Collaborative Care Program, and it's to start preparing for these older youth as they would be leaving our system. To help get them set up with guidance for once they're all of a sudden, just because you turn 18 doesn't mean you know what to do in life. So it's a little bit of a continuation program. We can help them get set up with a place to live, help them get jobs, help them if they're wanting to go to school, trying to help them that continuation program so that they're not just turning 18 and totally on their own. But it also, because they are 18, they have to want to be a part of the program.
What are the biggest stress points right now in the foster care system? Obviously, you've got an increase, a spike in the numbers. Where are the places that suppose, you know, we lived in a different kind of reality where money and resources never were objects or anything like that? Where could we make the greatest impact here? I'd like everyone's thoughts on that. I'll start with Angela.
I think just our greatest need at this time is just the pure need for homes. If we had more foster homes, the stress level right there.
Go ahead.
I would say just continuing to educate the community and our state as a whole, so that, you know, you may have somebody who's not necessarily wanting to be a foster parent, but can be a voice and may know somebody who can help impact. But I think our community in general just needs to have a greater awareness and understanding.
Okay. Tina.
You know, I think one of the first places we need to start is addressing the issue that's happening with the adult population. You know, there need to be appropriate treatment options and funding available to provide the addiction services that could help prevent some of these removals. But, you know, at the point that they've occurred, you know, there's a desperate need for foster families. There's a desperate need for families that are interested in adopting children and would become foster to adopt families to step up. You know, a few years ago, we kind of discouraged folks who wanted to adopt from going through foster care because they really struggled with letting the kids go back home. And sometimes that could be really hard for them emotionally. But at the point that we're at now, you know, we really educate them about the reality that, you know, some of the kids do go home, but we're seeing such a significant increase, especially in the number of really young children coming into the system. We need families that are willing to foster to adopt also.
I'm going to stay with you on this one, Tina. Is it difficult? As you say, there are times when the kids in foster care go back into their homes. Is that reentry a difficult process? Because I would think, as you say, it's, you know, for them to have been removed, the situation could not have been good, and it could not have been good for quite some time.
That's true, but there's always hope with the parents. You know, I've seen some pretty amazing recoveries by some of the families. I've seen the point where their children are removed being the bottom for that parent and the thing that drives them to change. Every family that comes into the system is different, and every parent's different in terms of what it is that they're dealing with and what their skill set is for being able to handle that. So I think that, you know, we see a lot of celebrations when kids go home, too. It's not often, I mean, it's not usually a negative thing.
We are talking about foster care here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Tina Clore, Angela Wolf, and Gwen Collell. I am John Krall. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about foster care today on No Limits. My guests are Tina Klor, who's with the Children's Bureau, Angela Wolf, who is the foster care specialist with the Department of Child Services, and Gwen Collell, who is director of Damar Foster Care Services. We've gotten an email from a listener named Lynn. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, I'm a little concerned that after all the work of fostering a child successfully, the foster parents are still at the mercy of the biological parents. Do the biological parents always have the final say? Angela.
I'm not sure. That's a very broad question. Mm-hmm. Parents definitely have legal rights. So it just depends. I mean, ultimately, the court is involved, so the court has the ultimate say in dealing with a foster child. So,
do foster parents have rights? I mean, obviously, you have, as a parent, you have, and guardian of a mm-hmm. child, you have certain rights and all of that. But what are the rights that foster parents have in this situation? Tina's leaning in, but I'll go with Angela first, and then I promise, Tina, you'll get a chance mm-hmm. to speak.
I'm not sure if it's necessarily rights, but mm-hmm. they have a voice. Mm-hmm. They are a part of the whole process. They have a voice in part of what helps the caseworker to be making their court reports. A lot of the information that's going to be going in involving the child, they are very vital. Foster parents are the direct connection to the child, and so they're sharing the information. They're speaking to the therapist. They're speaking with their caseworkers. So they are having their say because they're so vital because they handle the child. They're the ones who know them the best.
Tina.
The foster parents do have a voice while they're delivering the service. I think that foster parents, what we really have to work with them on the front end and understanding is they're there to provide a service. And that doesn't guarantee you rights. You know, legally, all of us as parents are, you know, we have parental rights. And, you know, those are protected by law and legislation. Foster families are there to do a service, to love those kids and provide for them and care for them at a time that's a very challenging time for them. But, you know, also to understand their role, you know, they have to accommodate the biological parents more or less. You know, those families are working their way through difficult situations. The parents are not all, you know, terrible people. They're people that are challenged. They're people who grew up without appropriate education, who lack resources. But they're people who are capable of making change also. So some of it's just getting your head around kind of what your role is when you're the foster family, mm-hmm. you know, and how that changes, you know, if that child becomes available for adoption, then you are talking about somebody at the point that they're adopted who has rights to that child.
We are talking about foster care here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Tobin, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I wanted to say hello to Angela because she was our caseworker for our foster care and our adoption, and we are one of her success stories. And I just wanted to say to any of your listeners who might be listening and considering foster care or foster to adopt that you should do it. It's a big challenge, and it's a big change, and it's a big step in your life, but the rewards greatly outweigh those challenges. And so that's basically why I was calling, just to say hi to Angela and to tell anybody who's listening, you should definitely look into your heart and try this.
Presumably you've done so, Tobin?
I'm sorry?
Presumably you have done so?
We adopted two boys from the Indiana foster care system almost 6 years ago now, and yep. they were 3.5 and 6 when we adopted them, and now they are in 4th and 7th grades, which is hard to believe that the time has gone so quickly, and they're thriving. And I think that it's been an amazing experience for our boys. It's been an amazing experience for our family and our friends and our extended family. And, you know, as you were saying, foster care doesn't always end in adoption. We were lucky that ours did, and we went into it knowing that it would. And so, but there are so many children that need good temporary and permanent homes, and I just, I'm hoping that people who are listening will make that consideration, because it's really an important and surprisingly easy process to go through if it's something that you're willing to dedicate your life to.
Thanks very much for the call, Tobin, and for sharing your story, and obviously for stepping up for those children. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much. Certainly.
Thanks, Tobin.
That's got to make you feel good, because, you know, the portrait I think that's emerging from this conversation is that, you know, foster care starts really from a point where you're attempting to avert disaster. You know, some really bad things happening in a child's life, and your goal. I mean, if there's one word that's been mentioned over and over again in this conversation, is just to achieve stability. Initially, that obviously is something that went well beyond stability.
Yes.
Where it turned it around. How common are stories like that, Angela?
Regularly. Mm-hmm. You know, again, because it can go twofold. It can be success story in that we have a successful reunification with the biological home. And we just had the privilege of an adoption 2 days ago. So mm-hmm. it's two ways that this can be successful. And so, you know, we often have foster parents who are able to help mentor even with the biological family and can have ongoing relationships post our involvement and able to continue to be involved in the children's lives and help the parents. And not every scenario can work that way, because not every parent wants help and wants involvement. But there's so many different ways that the success can go on beyond. Mm-hmm. But we do have success. We do have adoptions. If fostering to adopt, we're very thankful for the families who are willing to make that lifelong commitment to the children.
How common is having to deal with tension or friction between the foster parents and the biological parents? Gwen, you're smiling, so I'm gathering it's not an uncommon occurrence.
You know, actually, I was smiling because we have families that go into it thinking that there's going to be that friction mm-hmm. or that tension, or, oh, what's going to happen if I come across the biological family? How are they going to receive me? How am I going? What are we going to talk about? So why I was smiling is because we actually have so many more situations like Angela was speaking of, where there is collaboration between the foster parent and the biological parent, or the mentoring relationship, or, you know, the understanding that it takes a village and we're all in this as a team. So let's work together as the foster family and the biological family so that, you know, the child can find stability or reunification or whatever the outcome will be.
How do you structure that kind of conversation at the beginning with presumably foster parents, biological parents? You pull everybody into a room and say, in effect, yes, you know, the one thing we share here is an interest in this child, or how do you go about doing that? Now, everyone, it's like teaching a class. Everyone's avoiding eye contact. Tina, I'll go to you.
Well, there are child and family team meetings for every child. And so that's when all of the providers, the informal supports for the family, which could be, you know, their friends, their pastors, their whatever, they're allowed to invite. They invite them. And basically everybody gets together and talks about that child. And so I think those relationships happen naturally in that setting, because you're all really there for the same purpose. It's to move that child situation forward. And then you see, you know, in some situations, you'll see some foster families that end up being, you know, more or less grandparents to those children after they go home, or relative, you know, aunts, you know, you just continue to have those relationships where they're nurturing and bringing along the parents and giving them some support. I think most foster families are such giving people and merciful people that they have some empathy for the parents.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Dee. And again, if you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. says she just tuned in. Has the subject of foster children with disabilities who age out been addressed? No, I don't think it has. What happens with foster children with disabilities who age out? Angela, I'll start with you. But
there's always a plan. We just don't put them on a street corner.
Yeah.
Hopefully they're involved with the BEADS program for adults with disabilities. So there's always a plan of maybe where what procession we're moving them on to. It's a huge need in our community with mental health and disabilities. How do we help adults in our community? And so it's much different when you come from the services we have for children. We can make all their decisions for them. But it's a challenge, definitely, once they're aging up.
Who are the... You had a thought, Gwen?
I was just thinking that, you know, that process starts when a child is very young, too. So, I mean, the thought of what is it going to look like when this child turns 18 or is in their, you know, early 20s, we start planning for that at a very young age. So it's a fairly thoughtful process.
And depending on the type of disability as well.
Correct.
Who are the are there some children who are harder to place than others? Tina, you're nodding your head, so I'm going with you.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Who are they?
I think children who have a history of sexual abuse are harder to place because there are often a lot of challenges around placing them in homes with families that have children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of concerns there. We're working with children who have autism, some behaviors that are pretty significant for any family to provide support for, let alone a child that's not yours that's coming into the foster placement situation. Older, you know, adolescents are harder to place. Often it's hard. It used to be not as hard to get folks to take babies. Right now we have babies that we can't find homes for. But teens have always been more difficult because teens are naturally at a point where they, you know, developmentally, we all want to grow up and kind of push away from our parents in those teenage years. And when you enter a foster placement in that critical time, I think it can be challenging for some of them to transition. So sometimes it's harder to find families. You know, most parents don't like their own teenagers that much. They might not want to go grab up a few more. You know, so I think that those are some of the groups that are harder to place.
When you say that you've got babies that you can't place right now,
mm-hmm.
what happens when you can't place them?
My shelter is full.
Okay, so that's the and how many children do we have in that situation at any given time who can't be placed?
I think
when you say your shelter is full, that's a start. How many beds does your shelter have?
In Indy, we have 29.
29, so that's 29 kids who can't be placed right
Well, it's
now.
Not that they can't be placed. It may some of those families are there. Some of those kids are brought there by their parents because they're in crisis. Some of the children are coming from the Department of Child Services because they've done a removal at 2 a.m. and, you know, finding a foster home at 2 a.m. may not be the easiest, so we'll take care of them, the children, for a couple of days until DCS locates a home or whatever. But, you know, there's a lot of children available.
Mm-hmm. There is a move and towards even shorter-term placements where a home or a family would say, I'm available just for a very short term, you know, couple of days to a week until you can locate, you know, a more longer-term appropriate home. So I see some families stepping up that have availability to do just a shorter-term placement for a child until a longer term option is located.
How long typically does it take once a child has been removed from a troubled home or a troubled situation to be placed into a more permanent foster care situation? Angela?
We immediately have to find placement for the children. So I don't want it to sound like we have children just hanging around. We have to find a home, but it might be where it is a temporary, where until we can find a home that has the appropriate space for helping them. And we don't have necessarily a shelter I'm out in Hendricks County. We don't have a shelter for the children to go to for that emergency. So we have amazing foster parents who we try to get them to answer their phone at the night and call them up, and they will usually find a safe place to put them.
Mm-hmm.
And But it's such a growing need. And daily, sometimes we're, you know, sometimes we have caseworkers in the office until the wee hours in the morning as we are trying to locate a placement for the children.
Well, yeah, and I guess the spirit of my question here is not that yes, they're, you know, children stacked up like jets over O'Hare or anything like that, waiting, and it's a callous or indifferent system filled by people who don't care, because that's clearly not the case. It's more, you know, there is a process in terms of identifying what the child's needs are and then what the family's are, and I'm presuming that can't be done in 20 or 30 seconds. So how long is it generally from the time the child is removed to place where it's a more permanent situation?
Well, the caseworker is, you know, whoever's part of making the removal or making that determination is gathering as much information as possible in that time, because, you know, from a time a child is removed, we don't want a lag, you know, in where they need to go to office or
keep moving them as well. Right. That's very traumatic.
So a lot of information is gathered and passed on, and decisions are made very quickly in the span of, you know, an hour to a couple of hours, so that, you know, that child can not just be hanging out and they can transition into a safe, you know, environment quickly.
We're getting tight on time, so I'm going to give each of you about 20 seconds to answer this. What is the biggest misconception about foster care? I'll start with Tina.
I think there's a misconception that people are in it for money, which always makes me kind of laugh. I think my experience with foster families is that they're good people, and I know that they don't get paid enough for them to really for it to warrant anyone being in it for the money.
Okay. Gwen.
That's a good question. I would say maybe on the other side of it that the greatest misconception is that people who have their children removed are bad people or malicious in their intent, and that's not the case. I mean, those are people facing life's challenges and need support and advocacy as well. So.
Okay. Angela, you're going to get the last word.
I just think it's a great way to try to make a difference in our society. If you can make a difference in a child, and they may go home, but maybe they're going to take with it the values or things that they learned from you and your family and take that back with them, and hopefully it'll have a lasting effect on them.
Well, I think that is a good last word. I'd like to thank all of you for what has been an intriguing and at times moving conversation. I'd like to thank my guest, Tina Clore, who's with the Children's Bureau, Angela Wolf, who is with the Department of Child Services, and Gwen Kalel, who is director with Damar Foster Care Services. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.